It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll talk with a veteran NPR journalist about her battle with breast cancer and hear the advice she has for others fighting the disease. First, a new report out this week from the National Alliance on Mental Illness finds that those struggling with mental illness, for them, finding jobs can be incredibly difficult. And the statistics show that about 80% of people with mental illness are unemployed in the country. So what is that costing the country and those affected? And what can we do about it? Joining us now is the author of the report, Sita Deal. She's also the director of state policy and advocacy for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Sita, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Your report shows that 80% of the mentally ill are unemployed. That seems like a surprisingly large number. How significant is it?
Well, actually, the number, 80% of the people who receive public mental health services are unemployed. We really have no idea how many people overall, because people with mental illness don't necessarily disclose when they're working just out in the private sector. But the state mental health authorities report these numbers every year to the federal government. And that figure, 80% are unemployed, that is correct.
So the number could be higher if you were including people who weren't getting assistance.
Might be lower, actually.
Might be lower.
Yeah.
Well, why is it so high in general for people suffering from mental illness?
Well, mental illness can impair your ability to, concentrate, and you have a lot of medical appointments, and, so it's just difficult to get a job and keep a job sometimes. But the other thing is that there are programs that work, but the traditional vocational rehabilitation programs are kind of time-limited supports that focus on assessment and job placement. They don't focus on long-term job on-the-job support or support while a person is working. There are programs that have been developed, such as the Individual Placement and Support Program or the ACT program, which actually hails from Madison, Wisconsin, the Program of Assertive Community Treatment, which have supported employment embedded in the mental health service treatment planning and treatment delivery system. And those have been extraordinarily successful in helping people get and keep and succeed at on jobs. But those services are only available to less than 2% of the people who need them in the public system.
How many of the mentally ill that you studied want to work, want to have a job?
Somewhere between 60 and 70% want to work and would work if they had those services and supports. The other barrier to this is that people go back to work, they may be on disability income, and they may be getting Medicaid, which offers a much broader array of services, recovery-based services that really help people get well and stay well. And so they may go to work, and then they may find that their Medicaid benefits are jeopardized because they're starting to work more, or their Medicare benefits are jeopardized. They start into what is called a trial work period. And then people realize, I can't afford to lose these benefits. And they either cut down their employment to 5 or 10 hours a week just so that they will not jeopardize those benefits by having too much income, or they resign, or they continue, and then they lose access to mental health services, and then bad things happen, and they lose their job, and they're unemployed again. So this vicious cycle has been a major impediment to employment for quite a while, but that changes actually this year. With the Affordable Care Act, people can purchase individual plans. If they're above 100% of poverty, they get federal subsidies up to 400% of poverty. And that means that, and those plans must provide mental health benefits, and those benefits must be on par. So that removes a big barrier. You can keep your health coverage when you go back to work.
So do you expect to see that as a big boon for the mentally ill who'd like to be in a job and keep benefits?
Potentially, it's a big boon. It kind of depends on the robustness of the mental health benefits that are offered through these plans. But we can expect to see people who are, willing to take a risk going back to work and testing this. And we are going to do everything we can to make sure that this works.
What is this costing us as a country, both those suffering from mental illness and those who aren't, when so many of the mentally ill who are receiving benefits are unemployed?
Well, it's a major thing because people with mental illness are the largest and fastest growing group of Medicare and Medicaid and SSI and SSDI beneficiaries. You know, so this is costing us millions and millions of dollars.
One of the programs that you say is especially effective at getting the mentally ill into a job and helping them to keep that job is the sort of thing called supported work, I think. Correct me
supported
if I've got...
Supported employment.
Supported employment. Could you lay out for us how that works?
Sure. This is something that actually emerged out of the PAC program in Madison. What happens is people get an employment specialist who will sit down and talk with them and find out what kind of work they want to do, and then we'll place them rapidly in a job rather than having a long assessment and a long training period. And so they get placed rapidly in a job and find out if they like it, and then they can kind of work their way up the career ladder. Meanwhile, their mental health treatment is integrated so that the clinicians who are working with them, you know, understand their needs in the workplace, and they're getting on-the-job support from an employment specialist.
So let's say you're dealing with someone who's suffering from debilitating depression, and they find themselves in a period of depression, and they can't come into work for a while. Would their support person help be a liaison between them and their place of employment to smooth that over?
If they would like that. You know, it's really the person's choice. The person has to be able to choose, you know, those services and choose the level of intervention they would like. But if they would like that kind of intervention, then yes, their employment specialist would advocate on their behalf.
Are there still stereotypes of mental illness that are keeping mentally ill people from being hired in the first place?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Hired in the first place and keeping them from disclosing on the job. People with mental illness work throughout the workforce. You know, they're leading and innovating and creating and contributing. And yet many people, most people, I would think, choose not to disclose because they find that it has a chilling effect on career advancement. We're really hoping that that day is coming to a close.
So what do you think needs to be done to start bringing this unemployment number down?
We need to invest in services that work. And I have to applaud Wisconsin once again, just passed a law called the Individual Placement and Support Act. I guess it's Act 131, just passed it and allocated about $1 million to get these strengthen these programs and so that more people will have access to these programs.
And what do we get as a society if we take those steps to help mentally ill people get and hold jobs?
Well, we get the benefits, the talents that people with mental illness bring to the workforce. Families that are work really helps in your recovery. If you're going to work every day and you're interacting with people and you're doing something worthwhile, it's great for your self-esteem and great for your recovery. We find that over time, people have much less need for services. So the cost to the public purse for those services, not only are they reducing the disability dependence, but they're also costing less in terms of services over time.
Can you leave us with a story of someone that you've worked with or know about, have come across, who has been successful in reentering or entering the workforce and holding that job as a mentally ill person?
Sure. I know someone who was trained as a certified public accountant. She was suffering very debilitating mental illness, and she would lose job after job after job after job. And then eventually she got this sort of supported employment and got the kind of care integration that she needed and was placed in a job that really suited her temperament and her talents. And she has been very happily employed for, you know, well over a year now and shows up on the job. And she just said, when my feet hit the ground, I'm ready to go to work. You know, in the morning, I get up ready to go.
Great. Sita, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Sita Deal. She's Director of State Policy and Advocacy for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Our next guest is a veteran NPR journalist who got some alarming news a few years back. She was diagnosed with breast cancer. And while there was an overwhelming amount of information available about the disease, she felt like there was something missing. and she set out to fill the gap herself. We take a look back now at a conversation we had with Madalika Sikka. She's the executive editor for NPR News, and her new book is called A Breast Cancer Alphabet. Madalika, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica, for inviting me.
Well, as you were waiting for the call from your doctor with a diagnosis back in 2010, you were at a big moment in your journalism career at the White House. What do you remember about that day?
It was mostly a blur. I was the executive producer of Morning Edition at the time, and Steve Inskeep was interviewing the president. I knew that we would I would hear from the doctor at some point that afternoon. We finished the interview. We started looking at how we were going to edit it, and I saw there was a message from my doctor, and that's when I got the news. I called her. She didn't leave a voicemail. I did call her and had her paged, and she told me.
There's a lot of things going through your mind at that moment, all of the interview with the president going through your head along with words from your new vocabulary of breast cancer. And is that something that most women will remember their whole lives, that moment?
You know, I'm guessing that you probably will remember the diagnosis. That's something that even now, you know, more than 3 years later, I still remember quite vividly. But what I discovered that you probably might not remember much after that, and that's why I think it's really important to take notes. And that's not just because of my occupational hazard of being a journalist.
And there is a section for notes at the end of your book.
Yes. I think it's really important to have someone with you. My husband was my partner and stenographer, because you can be engaged in a conversation with your doctor, and then at some point it'll hit you, oh, she's talking about me. And you want someone to have been paying real close attention so you know what the doctor is saying to you. And if you have questions, you can go back. I think it's just really important to have. So we put blank pages at the back of the book so people can keep their own notes.
And that's one piece of advice, keeping notes. And your book is full of advice and also empathy. And you write that you found a lot of support from your science journalist friends, your family. You also found just an onslaught of information, but there were still gaps in the knowledge pool. What kinds of things were missing from the picture for you?
Well, I think the challenge in, you know, the information age is, the great thing is we live in the information age. The terrible thing is that we live in the information age. And it's really hard to sort it all out. And I think at particular stages as you're going through this, you know, at the beginning, I knew that if I had started, you know, penetrating the internet, I would have found all sorts of horrible and alarming things. So I very purposefully did not do that. There's a lot of great information out there in books, but most of it seemed very medical. I didn't find too much that was very focused on, well, what am I going through, me as a woman, me as a person, as opposed to the things that were happening to me medically.
And one of the things that you acknowledge is anxiety. It's the first letter in your book. It's probably not something you'd find on a healthcare website about breast cancer. But after your diagnosis, how big a part of your life was anxiety?
It's a big part. It actually starts even before the diagnosis, because in my case, you know, I had a mammogram and they call me back. And in that period where you're waiting to go back, you're anxious. And then you wait for the test and then you get the diagnosis. There's all sorts of anxiety. And it doesn't really go away. It just either recedes or comes to the forefront, depending on what stage in the treatment you're at.
It seems as though you enter a zone where things get very topsy-turvy very quickly. If you take, for instance, breast cancer, we're talking about your breasts, and this is something that has been private your whole life. And all of a sudden, everyone's talking about your breasts in a very clinical, public way. You say there are people taking pictures of your breasts. Well, how can women deal with that transition?
Well, you know, I have to say the photographs were quite a shock to me. But, you know, what your surgeons do is they want to know what they're dealing with, and what your plastic surgeon, if you have reconstruction, wants to know what he's going to do to try and make you whole. So it was shocking at first, because I was like, whoa, wait a minute, you're taking pictures and, you know, they're anonymous and he knows they're you, and it actually helps him do his work better. But it's really hard to deal with. It's really hard to deal with. So I thought that if it hadn't been a surprise to me, I might have, you know, dealt with it a little better at the beginning.
I noticed you said she when you were referring to the doctor and he when you were referring to your reconstructive surgeon. Do you think that's a norm for most women, that they're dealing with this very intimate part of their body, but it's a male surgeon?
I don't think so. It was just one of those quirks that I happen to have had a male plastic surgeon, but all my other doctors were female. I think it was a quirk. I must say I don't know enough to know whether most of the plastic mm-hmm. reconstruction surgeons are male or not, but it didn't strike me as something that was very deliberate.
Another letter in your alphabet, H, and you have hair as the topic of interest there. Now, in the face of a life or death illness, worrying about your hair seems like it might come in kind of low on the list, but you write to women that it's okay to freak out and to grieve over the loss of your hair. What advice do you have for women going through chemo-related hair loss?
It is tough, and I think it's okay to feel that way. What's interesting is, I've had male friends who've gone through cancer and who've lost their hair, and it's really not such a deal. It just is for women. I think if we accept that, for most women, I should say, just accept that and, live with it. I mean, what I chose to do was I actually had my hair shaved before it fell out. And that was as a result of talking to several people who had gone through treatment, and they felt that, waking up with a clump of your hair on the pillow was sort of really difficult to deal with, and you don't have much control over many things, and I could control when I lost my hair by choosing when to do it. So for me, it worked. And I think that that is something I would encourage women to think about, what would work for them.
And when you shaved your head, you didn't do it in a solitary bathroom stall. It was with your friends and family, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, there is a hairdresser here that was recommended to me by, I'm sort of always amazed at how often I say recommended to me or something I learned from somebody else I knew, because so many women I know had gone through breast cancer. And he was terrific. He actually, I got a wig through him. He styled the wig and he said, we can shave your hair any way you like. If you want to bring your family, they do it in a private room. And so my daughters and my sister and some girlfriends and my husband were there, and we did it.
What was it like?
I had never thought of myself as bald, so it was tough, but you have to kind of roll with it. And I discovered that the shape of my head really wasn't that bad. But it is sort of, you take a breath when he brings the razor to your head and you start shaving. And it's like, there's no turning back now.
Was it helpful to have people there to cry with you?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was. And I think, it was, my girls were a little younger then. They were in, lower school and middle school. And I think probably for me, I thought it was better for them to be there with me and see it happen as opposed to me come home one day bald.
We're listening to a conversation we had with Madalika Sikka, who shared her advice for women dealing with breast cancer. And you can join the online conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. Have you or someone close to you experienced breast cancer? What do you know now that you have wished that you knew then? What don't people understand about what it's like to have breast cancer? And what advice would you like to share? You can head on over to the Central Time Facebook page and post your comments there. And we also have a show hotline. If you'd like to leave us a message, that number 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422. You can leave your suggestions for guests and topics there. We continue the conversation we had with Madalika Sikka about living with breast cancer. She's executive editor for NPR News, and she was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2010. Her book is called A Breast Cancer Alphabet. And you can join the online conversation. Do you have advice on dealing with the day-to-day reality of living with breast cancer? If you or someone close to you has dealt with the disease, what do you wish you had known going in? You can post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. And Madalika, I want to talk with you about the word journey, because this is something that kind of sticks in your craw. People seem to want to apply it to the process of being diagnosed with and treating breast cancer. But what is it about the word journey that gets overused?
I think for me, journey is very much rooted in the sort of real here and now and going from place to place. And I have been fortunate enough to travel a lot, and I've taken some great journeys. And I think that when I hear people talk about your breast cancer journey, it sort of tries to impose something mystical about it, and it's not mystical. It's a disease. The treatment is terrible, and I don't think people don't talk about your heart disease journey or other. I don't know why it is so attached to cancer and breast cancer in particular, but having taken some great journeys, I'd like to just think about journeys in that way and not what I went through.
Did you ever voice that when people tried to use the J word with you?
Yeah, I think people know me well enough to know that they wouldn't have used it. Yes, I mean, what's been interesting is the kinds of things I've talked about with people. It's made them think about how they engage with people that they know who've gone through it. And it's been heartening to hear from people who have read the book, who have either gone through breast cancer and have, you know, said to me they wish they'd had this book then, or people who are going through it now who have really appreciated it as a companion.
Let's take a caller now. We have Alexis on the line from Monona. Hi, Alexis.
Hi, how are y'all doing?
Pretty good. How about you?
Oh, I'm great. I am a 10-year survivor of breast cancer.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. And I was a young woman. I was barely 40 when I was diagnosed, and in the best shape of my life. And one thing that I kind of wish that people did for me, and granted it was with the good intentions, was they gave me motivation material. Oh, this woman ran a marathon when she was going through chemo, and I was hurting, and I was sick from the chemo, and I had bone pain. And I just wanted to know that it was okay that I felt that way, that there were days I stayed in bed, and it was okay. And not to, I had to get up and go do something, even though I'm, very, very ill.
I think you are a woman after my own heart. I mean, I think that's something that I talk about in the book. The letter Q is for quitting. And precisely for those days where, I'm not getting out of bed. I feel terrible. And this is what I need to do for me right now. I think there's a bit of a pressure, the kind of breast cancer culture that has grown up, that you have to deal with it in a particular way. And what I want to do is let people know that, no, you can deal with it whichever way works for you.
And Alexis, did you have any more comments on that?
One more quick thing is that I kind of wish that I had not rushed into reconstruction. I barreled through this. I said, I know I want implants. I know I want this. And I to get my surgery, so I didn't have to have so many surgeries. I kind of bundled things together. I had the implants chest expanders put in when I had my mastectomy, and then I had my oophorectomy when I had my implants put in. And I did the research. I did all the research I could about the cancer survival and the treatment, but not enough about what happens afterwards. And I encourage women to take their time and research that well, because they're pretty heavy decisions on how you're going to look when you're done.
I think that's really excellent advice.
All right, Alexis, thank you so much for calling in and sharing. And again, congratulations. And Menelik, let's talk about the word that Alexis just used, mastectomy. It's a word that enters the picture for a lot of women who have breast cancer. It's this tidy clinical package for something that's pretty drastic. What is your real-world view of what that word means?
Well, my real-world view is if we talked about it as an amputation, I think we would treat it differently. And it's funny how in sort of day-to-day parlance we use this medical term, a mastectomy, when in fact something quite brutal is happening to you. And for me, I sort of felt like I could handle it better in describing it as a amputation, because that's what it felt like and looked like to me. It's very painful. I think that when we use a clinical term, we don't think about the fact that it's a very drastic measure, and it hurts. And that's another thing nobody really knows before they go through it.
Right. And did you share that with the people around you, that this wasn't, just a medical procedure? This was a part of you.
Yeah. Well, I was, yes. I mean, I think to the extent that I was comfortable talking about it, certainly with my my sisters and my, girlfriends, and actually my husband as well. There is pain attached with it. I wasn't, bouncing out of bed 2 days after I'd had the surgery. It's major surgery.
I want to talk about one other point Alexis made. And by the way, we'd like to invite you to call in on this. We're talking with Madalika Sicca, executive editor for NPR News, and she was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2010. Her new book is called A Breast Cancer Alphabet. And our caller Alexis talked about, you know, women who ran marathons when they were going through chemotherapy or through the breast cancer treatment. And that brings me to the warrior aspect, which you write about in your book, about there sometimes seems to be this challenge, this idea of beating and fighting cancer. Why didn't the idea of being a warrior fit your experience?
It didn't fit my experience because I struggled with the treatment. It also didn't work for me. And I think one of the sort of downsides of this attitude, if you have to have this attitude of you've got to kick it and you've got to be very martial and about it all and have that kind of attitude, it implies that if you don't, then you don't deserve to get better, or that, like, you know, I like to say a bad attitude didn't give me cancer and a good attitude won't get rid of it. And, you know, I know too many people whose cancer has come back. Metastatic cancer is a real issue for women, metastatic breast cancer. And so the implication is that if you didn't, if somehow you, you know, 40,000 women a year die of it, did they not fight? Did they not want to live? Were they not, you know, fighting all the way through? There's an implication there that just doesn't sit well with me.
It's sort of one of the bigger picture things. What you're saying here is whatever your experience is going through this, it's valid and it's okay. You don't have to try to embody a warrior. You don't have to go on a mystical journey. Whatever happens to you is okay.
Yeah, whatever works for you. And I think, you know, the writer Peggy Orenstein wrote a great piece in the New York Times Magazine called Our Feel-Good War on Breast Cancer. And I think we sort of tip the balance. It has become a feel-good war. You know, something, the breast cancer awareness movement is an extraordinarily important episode in women's health and vital to women's health. And we're aware, and now we have to help people get through it. And I think that you've got to get through it in a way that works for you.
Do you think there's something about it being a woman's disease that invites the warm fuzzies?
Probably. Probably. That's a rash generalization. I know people may criticize me for that. But yeah, you know, and I think that the tough thing about when you are going through it, when you see all these campaigns and these, you know, pink teddy bears and the NFL clad in pink, and it's hard to find a direct line from the NFL being clad in pink to what I went through. And so I think awareness is really important. And I would venture to say that what I'm trying to do is, in this book, is to make people aware of the things they might not have been aware of in these campaigns.
In terms of the support people that surround a woman with breast cancer, do you have advice for them about how to be supportive and do the right things and not annoy and all of that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, talking to the loved one in your life and for the patient, you know, being very clear about what you need and what you don't need. People really want to help you and they want to do something useful. So, you know, I talk about this in the book, and K is for kindness. People will ask you what they can help you with, and you have to think about it not too long and not too hard, and then you have to tell them what you need. And it may be, you know, dropping your kid off somewhere or driving you to the hospital, or it may be feeding your family, which, you know, all my friends got together and had a rather elaborate, amazing calendar online where we were fed for 5 months. And, you know, that is huge. And I don't want anything, you know, that was exactly what we needed. So I think a little bit of honesty and really mean it. If you want to ask someone, what can I do to help, really mean that you want to help.
And once a woman is through her diagnosis, the surgery, the treatment, you know, there'll always be drugs to take and check-ins down the road. But you write that the memories never really go away. So what kind of comfort can you leave women with for life after cancer?
I think that, you know, managing your anxiety and knowing that that's what you're living with and calibrating it within the rest of your life. You know, I would never say to anyone that, well, you should just forget about it, it's done, because I don't feel that way. It's not done. And as I say, metastatic breast cancer is a really important issue. And many other cancers come back. You know, there is no cure. What they're doing is reducing the odds of it coming back. But who knows if there's some errant cell running around. It's not at the forefront of my head, but It's there somewhere in the background.
And you're back to life, though. It's the things, the day-to-day life that you want back, that I guess that part can come back.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You find that, you know, your life wasn't really that bad before. So getting back to it is a good thing.
Madalika, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
That was Madalika Sicca, executive editor for NPR News and author of A Breast Cancer Alphabet. Every week at this time, we like to share something with you. And this time, Stephanie Elkins is back to share some tunes. Stephanie is the host of WPR's Morning Classics and Simply Folk. Stephanie, welcome back.
Well, thanks, Veronica. Great to be here.
So what did you bring for us this time?
Well, we have multiple genres, a little bit of folk and bluegrass, a little bit of classical, some Native American flute.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to start things off with a band with Wisconsin roots. This band is called Dead Horses. What do we know about them?
Well, they're out of Oshkosh, and they do some really wonderful songwriting, kind of a modern approach to American roots music and some really introspective songwriting. And they have really started to get some momentum in Wisconsin and beyond. They were just here about a month ago for a session at Wisconsin Public Radio, and we're going to hear a clip from that session. The sound came out very good.
Oh, that's fantastic. They performed here, and you got to hear them up close and personal. Mm-hmm. And you say that they do something that I love. They have four-part
yes.
harmonies, those dense, rich harmonies that are so fun to listen to.
That's right. You and I both love to sing harmony, and that's something that attracts me all the time. It's one woman and three men, and she's the primary singer, and then they sing some wonderful harmonies.
And this is a track called Glitterbug. Anything you want to tell us about it?
She was raised by a preacher, and it's an introspective song, and it's about restlessness and finding beauty in strange places. And she wrote it when she was at a tough time, kind of a time of desperation, she said. And the message is that there's hope.
Okay, let's listen.
In the forest, in the old hobo's tales, in the country, and in the wide open sails, there's a feeling brings me to my knees. There's a belief in something more than me, in something more than me. And in some churches, and in the old, old hymns, and the corner street bars, and the motels where they live, there's a feeling in the core of myself. There's a sadness wishing for something else, wishing for something else. Lost, I know, we've all been told, still can't shake.
This is a track called Glitterbug from the band Dead Horses, and looks like there are some opportunities for people to hear these folks around Wisconsin this summer, Stephanie.
That's right. They're doing a lot of gigging, and they'll be at the Backwoods Bluegrass Bash in Amberg, Wisconsin, also in Milwaukee, and in Batavia, Illinois, in Manawa, in Green Lake. That's all in July, and you can find that on their webpage, which is deadhorses.net.
And you do the thing a little bit like, I'm blanking on the name of it now. Well, if you like these bands, then you'll also like this band. These bands. What are they similar to?
Well, you know, they recorded this new CD. It's not out yet, in San Francisco, where the Grateful Dead did a lot of their work. And so they do a lot of that jam kind of stuff. And they sound like some of the more progressive bluegrass bands that are so popular right now, like Trampled by Turtles and Mumford and Son, even Old Crow Medicine Show, that kind of thing, Punch Brothers.
Great. So they're in that alley there. But it's a great opportunity to hear a Wisconsin band. And are they getting some national play? Are they moving up?
I don't know about national play, but they are certainly getting a lot of attention in the Midwest. And they're starting to, they've been on the East Coast, and so they are just right at the cusp. I think they're going to be big. I really do. They're just, the songwriting's very strong and the musicianship's really strong.
Great. Thanks for sharing that. And we've got another one from Wisconsin. This is from someone we've actually interviewed here on Central Time, Frank Montano.
You know, he's going to be appearing at the World Convention, the World Flute Convention in Eau Claire, which is coming up in a couple of weeks. And he just makes miracles happen through one little flute. It just blows my mind. And he brings a certain sensibility to playing, and it automatically just makes me, anyway, start to feel something different.
And this is a track of his called Loon Song. track there called Loon Song by Frank Montano. And he's from Wisconsin, the Red Cliff Reservation, but he tours all over the world.
He does. He's known as a Native American flute maker and performer. He's also a songwriter and a musician of other genres. But he was nominated for the 2013 Native American Music Awards. And he's really a mentor to a lot of folks in that genre. And he's well known. We're lucky that he's here in Wisconsin. I've seen him perform, and you connect to him emotionally.
Yeah. We had him right over there where you're sitting about, and it was a treat to be so close to him performing on those flutes. Interesting points here that his flute music is used for, you know, not just the enjoyment of music, but in some other circumstances too.
That's right. In healing, even in childbirth, and for meditation purposes. And he trained with elders from the Ojibways. That's how he learned to play flute. So he really came at it from the spiritual perspective.
And we're going to go on to another genre here, a little bit like our first one. Nora Collins, a country singer. Tell us about her.
She's out of Milwaukee. She's really young. She's, I think, 19 years old. She has already had 3 CDs out, and she is starting to open for some of these big country acts. In fact, she's going to be opening for Ronnie Millsap in Milwaukee, and she's worked with the American Idol winner Lee DeWise and Josh Turner, and she's just got a new acoustic album out, and this is a song that's just a fun summer breezy song. It's straightforward. It's about riding on the back of a Harley, another, of course, Wisconsin institution.
Okay, and she's only 19. Well, let's listen.
Yeah.
Speed limit sign says 45. You're going over 60. 'Cause no one's around in this sleepy town. But you and me, baby, late night ride, holding on tight to your body. Feels so right on the back of your bike. Where you gonna take me tonight? Like a rocket on the road, baby, let's go.
All right, that's a song called Harley. And, wow, her voice is what struck me right off the bat. I mean, the melody and the music is beautiful, but she's got a really striking, beautiful voice.
Classic country voice, I mean, but really unique. And she just won the 2014 Singer-Songwriter of the Year Award for the Wisconsin Area Music Industry Awards in Milwaukee. And that's pretty prestigious. And the fact that she's 19, she's won the Rising Star Award a couple of times. But she's really, I think, another one, a Wisconsin artist who's going to be making more of a name for herself.
Have you had the chance to see her live?
Yes, actually, she came and played on Simply Folk. She was one of the first interviews I did when I took
really?
Over the show. She was still in high school then.
Has she changed a lot over those years?
Really maturing, the songwriting especially.
Yeah. It's a time where I imagine you're getting a lot of experience under your belt and experimenting and growing into your own voice. So it'll be exciting to watch her.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we're going to end with a different genre. We're going to switch and put on your other hat as classical music host and look at some violin music.
That's right. Anne Akiko Myers is a violinist, and she plays an instrument that just sold for $16 million.
Wow.
And this was covered on NPR, and the story is posted on the NPR classical blog.
Is it a Stradivarius?
It is a Stradivarius. No, it's a Guarneri. I'm sorry.
Guarneri. Yet they're the two big names in violin making in the classical world.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. It's 200 and some years old, almost 300 years old, and she has it on loan to play until she is finished playing for her entire life.
Really?
Yep. So it was purchased by an anonymous donor who wanted to have it available for her. We're going to hear an excerpt from Vivaldi's Summer, and it's about, you can hear the storm coming. He's sort of depicting hail coming onto the crops in the summertime, and then the violin enters pretty strongly.
And so that is the sound of a $16 million violin. Although if I were playing, it would not sound anything like that.
No.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it really is incredible. It's a sweet, beautiful sound. It apparently has more wood than most other violins of its types, and that gives it a more depth to its sound. This is the first time it's ever been recorded. This is a brand new recording just out this year by Anna Kikomayos and the English Chamber Orchestra.
Really? It's the first time the violin has ever been recorded?
Mm-hmm. The previous owner had it under his bed for 50 years and it was never played.
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm so glad it's out into the world making music again.
Yeah.
What a pleasure.
Yeah.
Well, Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this music with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's always a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Stephanie Elkins, host of WPR Simply Folk and also Morning Classics. She drops by pretty often to share some new music with us.